In a time of great change, we're all making efforts to become more ethical, more educated people. The Transaction Podcast interviews guests from many different backgrounds to bring diverse aspects of the human experience to life through humour, authenticity, and personal stories. We are privileged to get a glimpse into other people's realities and to get first-hand advice and information from people on the front line of great social change. I'm Harris Eddie Hill, an out and proud trans non-binary person, an inclusive mental health coach and a best-selling author, and this is the Transaction Podcast. Hey everyone, and welcome back. Today I'm joined by Edward Miskey. Hey!
Hello!
Did I say your name right?
You did.
Amazing. That's really good.
On top of it.
Edward was very kind in looking for podcasts to guest on and saved me a job. So thank you.
Because you're welcome.
Normally I'm messaging people like, hey, would you like to be a, you know, loving your work right now, and would you come and be on? And Edward messaged me, and then I have seen Edward's stuff on TikTok and was like, amazing.
I'm trying to rebrand the TikTok. It needs to go back to like more of like, I want it to be a more of a personality piece, because right now it's just like, you know, it's historical and or other facts about New York City. And then I was just in London and Paris for a couple of weeks. And so I have a whole series on that too. So I'm trying to like redirect, and TikTok does not like that.
Yeah, it doesn't. Are you going to start a different channel, or do you want to save the one that you've got?
No, I'm going to save the one I've got. You know, I have a decent following, so I don't want to trash it.
Yeah. And sometimes, like, I've rebranded many big platforms I've had over the years, like multiple times. And I think it just takes a bit of time, and then it'll pick up again.
Yeah. Well, and I kind of, I guess, naively thought that like, oh, like insane cancer situations and stories would like take off and people would want to hear them. But I have been blocked by the algorithm. They do not want to hear from me.
So you've done, so the historically your TikTok has been all about New York and the fact that you live in New York and the historical facts and interesting things. But it also says in your bio that you're an author and you're an actor. Do you want to talk to us a bit about what you've been doing in the creative world?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's kind of it's a loaded question without you knowing it. It's a loaded question. Just because, you know, of course, as like people who work in arts and entertainment, a lot of times we're doing 100 things at once, you know, and the book kind of came about a couple years ago. I had self-published it and didn't do much with it. It was just a thing I wanted to do. And, you know, I've been performing, I'd predominantly doing musical theater for the last, I don't know, 100 years of my life. And, you know, most recently, to rip this Band-Aid off, I was Billy Flynn on the national tour of Chicago. And right before they left, I was replaced last minute. And, you know, it was kind of like, you know, it happens all the time. It's a thing. There's like really famous stories about like Patti LuPone and Sunset Boulevard and that whole thing. And, you know, it's a messy situation to be in. And of course, nobody likes to be in that situation, but it is what it is. And so I'm kind of looking at this as like, well, if I was on the road, I wouldn't have been able to do all the things with the book, which I have reissued this year, because this year is my 10-year cancer-free anniversary from the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma I had, which I was a sole survivor of the type I had. I don't know if that is still true, but it was true.
Wow.
I'm assuming it is, because if it was true once, it's probably true because I'm the first. So, like, you know, because the whole thing was that I was the first person who had lived as long as I did without a reoccurrence and who lived.
So, wow.
That's, yeah, I wasn't told that until I think my third or fourth year out. And then my doctor told me that, and I was like, oh, I really wish you wouldn't have told me that. And it's, you know, because it's like, if it comes back, then you're the baseline case study for that particular type, and you're the protocol.
Yeah.
And so like, if it kind of sort of worked the first time, then like, if it comes back, it's like, ooh, relying on technology and advancements doesn't give me a lot of confidence.
Yeah, that's heavy. You kind of want people to like make less of a deal about it, right?
Yeah, well, and as you know, kind of like we were talking about before we came on here, like, you know, I often forget that it happened at all because my life is so different now. And like, it's not because I went through a boatload of therapy. You know, I definitely didn't do that. I went through a couple months of it when things were as bad as they got. And then I stopped doing it because it wasn't helpful anymore. It just became frustrating. So, you know, on my end of things, I think I've either, you know, boxed it and compartmentalized it so tightly that I don't think about it, or I really have just kind of like moved on and it's just a piece of the puzzle of who I am and it doesn't really affect my daily life. Except for now, I'm selling a book about it. So let's unpack that box.
So we were messaging when we were talking about doing a podcast, and I think I'm only a year younger than you, or bet maybe not even a whole one. And I
Maybe.
also, yeah, and I also had a brush with
Yeah.
cancer at 25.
Do you mind me asking?
Yeah, it was cervical cancer.
Okay.
They got it early enough. I feel like a bit of an imposter saying, because you think cancer, you think chemo, you think losing hair, you know, being in hospital for a long time, but they got it early enough that I say all they had to do was cut it out. Like, that in itself was like a terrible experience. Like, when people complain about getting their smear test done, which granted are not pleasant, I'm like, mate, you're so much better off doing that than, you know, being in a position where it then becomes cancerous and you have to take it out.
Yeah,
And
well, and also I'd be curious to ask, like, because obviously, like, you're in the UK and I'm in the States. I almost, you know, the conversation of me living through this would have been very different if I waited a little longer. You know, I was out doing a show, I
yes.
was on a contract and like couldn't really leave, and I had this very, very visible tumor growing under my arm, and it was like 5 or 6 months that I let it go. And when I was checked into the hospital the first time, they let me know that I was stage 1B. And if it would have progressed to stage 2, it would have been a very different protocol conversation, which is like, bleh. But the reason why people do that, and I think a lot of times, you know, we don't go get checked for things and things progress to stage 2, 3, 4, et cetera, you know, is because the healthcare system here is so fucked up, in a word.
Yeah.
That, you know, we can't just, a lot of people can't just like get up and go to a hospital or get up and go to a doctor because it's going to cost them a couple thousand dollars. And some people don't have that. And at the time, I really didn't have insurance that worked out of state. I had state insurance and it wasn't good and it barely covered anything. It covered, I think, like emergency rooms and like some medication. But, you know, I was out in Reno, Nevada, of all places, doing this show and I had this huge tumor and I went to the emergency room. You know, and got hit with like a $2,000 bill. So, you know, I think a lot of times we ignore these things, and you were lucky that they caught it early. And I wonder if that is kind of like because culturally speaking, in regards to healthcare, you have this like, I guess freedom is the word to just like walk into a hospital and be like, hey, something's wrong, or like, hey, I feel like I need a look at, you know. And we don't always have that. So and not knowing what the specificities of your situation were, but I feel like that plays a role in it in a way.
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely no barrier between me getting my smear test done, because here, you know, I think from the age of, they start at 25 inviting you, and then you have one every 3 years. And providing that you go every 3 years, they estimate that if at any point you're going to develop cancer, it's likely that they'll catch it if you go once every 3 years.
Yeah.
And I think once you get to a certain age, I don't know if you stop going at a certain age. I don't know. I haven't got there yet. So, you know, I was definitely invited to do it, and money didn't get in the way of me going. So that's definitely true. But one of the barriers that does exist in medicine here, and obviously I've never been to the US, so I couldn't say, not yet, anyway, one day. But one of the things that definitely exists in medicine here is misogyny. And obviously, being non-binary but still perceived as a woman. I love women so much. I'm just not one. That's all of that stuff's like definitely relevant. And like my I know it was a little while ago now. It's like 21, nearly 22 years ago. My grandmother had a persistent cough, and she went to the doctors for ages. She was like, "There's definitely something wrong with me. I definitely need help. Like, this cough is not going away." They would send her off with antibiotics or be like, "Nah, you're fine, you're fine." And sure enough, by the time she persisted, they tested and she had fucking lung cancer, and it had spread to other areas of her body. I think it was in her bones. Like, she was, bless her, she was fucked. So I think she was known to have cancer for, I think she got diagnosed in the summer, and I don't know if she lasted 6 months or 18 months. I remember she died in the spring.
Yeah. I mean, I think that exists here, but specifically for women of color, non-white women. There's a slew of conversation around that, where it's perceived that women of color don't feel as much pain as white women do. It's nonsensical, but you know.
I think, yeah, it's the same here. I think this is maybe going off topic a bit. I saw someone a little while ago, an academic, explaining that classism and racism, when we compare the UK and the US, are both present, but it's just that in the UK, the kind of hierarchy and system of exploitation is more built on class. So we have racism here. It's not as much of a favorite as classism.
Well, and having just been to the UK for the first time and traveled in several upper circles, let's call them, that was like the first thing I noticed. And there were, non-white people present, but it was very like, this is how much this cost, and this is how much this cost, and this is the neighborhood I'm in, and it was very that.
You
Which
definitely.
was kind of new, because like, I don't think I experienced that here to that degree, if at all.
Yeah, that's the thing. And then, this academic or whatever was saying that in the US it's the other way around, because so much of the country was built off the exploitation of people of different races. So, I'm pretty sure I've seen statistics for UK healthcare with women of color here. We have a thing called BAME here, which is like Black, and Asian minority ethnicities or something. But either way, same thing, people of color. But yeah, women of color here also have poorer outcomes in healthcare. So.
Nonsense. And the thing is, like, knowing that, fundamentally knowing that, more so now than I did 10 years ago when I was in the hospital, like, I had a horrible time getting insurance approved, getting appointments approved, having bills go through, doing all kinds of other things. And like, I'm a big white guy. Like I couldn't even imagine if like one of those factors was not present. Like, I'm a cisgendered white guy. Like, if I have to come off as straight, I can. I don't want to. It doesn't have to be a thing. I spent years code switching. I'm not into it. But like, I had a rough time, and it I know is 100 times worse for, non-white people. So like, yes, I mentioned that in my story and I talk about it, but it's like, I think we kind of get into this place of comparing, like, well, I had it worse. It's like, well, yeah, of course you did, but like, that's not my story. And that's what I'm talking about.
I think like, I don't know about you, but the biggest thing for me in going through cancer was the emotional isolation of not being it. I mean, while I had like, I know I keep like quantifying it, but like, even though it was a mild situation, I still feel like I went through this thing of like, oh my God, I'm mortal. And what if I died? And no one would let me talk about that. They're like, but you won't die. You won't die.
Right. Well, I mean, And like the thing is, like, another thing that I talk about a lot is like my experience does not negate your experience. Like, yes, mine was extreme and it was kind of crazy, but that doesn't mean that yours is any less like scary for you because it happened to you. And again, that's kind of what I meant by saying, like, it's my story and that's what I'm talking about. But of course, yours is different. So like your experience with that, you know, regardless of the severity of the treatment, is still this mirror of like, oh, I am capable of dying. Because yeah. I think to a degree, we all have main character syndrome where, you know, this is my life. And like, of course, I'm going to be immortal. And why would I die? Like, that's not a thing that's going to happen to me. And then you face, then you face something like that. And it's like, oh, shit. You know, like it becomes very clear, like, oh, this is a thing that happens to people.
Yeah.
And like, I've been at funerals of relatives and friends and I've seen people die and like, I know it happens, but it hasn't happened to me. So it's a little bit more difficult to understand, which is the paradox of life, isn't it? Like, I'm never going to understand death because hasn't happened to me. But when it does happen to me, there's going to be no one to explain it to because I will be gone.
I don't know. Like, I've been to a lot of funerals in my lifetime. I think up to date, between 40 and 50, it's usually at least one a year for me. So I'm like really well adjusted about death, and I think always have been, but I at 25 didn't think I'd be facing it then. I thought that this was like a feeling and a concept and a mindset I would be facing when I was old.
Yeah. Well, and it changes you too, because you have to look at that. Like, I was sitting in a hospital bed at one point talking with my parents about funeral possibilities. Like, what would I want? And I was 25 years old, you know, like that's not a thing that you think of when you're like, I'm 25. Let's talk about my burial process. Like,
yeah,
it's like, I mean, I laugh about it because in hindsight, it is kind of ridiculous. Like, what a ridiculous situation to be in. You know, as serious as it was and as scary as it was at the time, like being removed from it and knowing that I'm okay, you know, and having expressed that in various ways throughout my life, including this book, like it's very much like, you know, I get to laugh at it and I get to see it from a different perspective and be like, ha ha ha, wasn't that funny when I was talking about being buried in a tree pod? Like, ha ha ha.
So did you find that you... people around you allowed you to talk about those things?
I was very lucky that I had a very strong support system. One of the things that I talk about is actually abandonment. Maybe that's too strong of a word, but betrayal, maybe? I don't really know. I had a boyfriend at the time, and he could not handle the diagnosis, but didn't tell me that. So he just started dating other people while still pretending to date me. I found out, and obviously we broke up, and I had like a whole meltdown about it, and it was not cute. It was not my finest hour, but you know, who could blame me for that? Oh. But again, like one of those hindsight things, I have a friend whose fiance had ALS, and at one point he had asked a friend of mine out on a date, and they were like, you have a fiance? Like, and he was like, no. Like, I am her boyfriend, but she is not my girlfriend. And the way that he explained it was that that's what she needed. She needed him to be there because her life had turned into the direction it did. But her dying was going to happen, and he was going to have a life after that. And so he needed to make sure that he still had one. And hearing that perspective when I heard it, which was several years after I was out of the hospital, was very like, oh, shit. You know, because like you think, oh, this person broke up with me during my biggest hour of need. How dare they? You know, but if the shoe were on the other foot, like, would I stay? I don't know. Like, I mean, I guess that would depend on if like we were together for years and years and years, or if we were married, or if we had property. And even then, like, people leave. People aren't equipped for that kind of thing. Not everyone is stable enough to face that kind of situation. And it was a really bizarre time. Like, it was literally Tony Sunday. I'm in a hospital room watching the Tonys, you know, Broadway award show. And I am getting this call from this guy that like, it's over. And so like, you know, it was not comfortable, but looking back from that perspective, it was very like, I get it. It's not good, but I get it. you know. And I also had friends, you know, like I had a, back then I had a trio of my closest that we were kind of like thick as thieves and did everything together. But once I told one of them that I had cancer and I was going to be in the hospital, I never to this day heard from them again. Wow. And it just happens. People are not equipped for that. And if there's one thing I could tell someone who is going into a situation like this, is just be prepared for the people who are going to leave and look at it as a good thing, because then you know who your friends are.
Mm.
And like, I know my family will stick by me regardless. You know, I know who my best and closest friends are and that they will stick by me regardless. So it hurts at the moment, but in the end, it's a really good thing. Because like, yeah, it hurts and you'll get over it and maybe it'll still hurt a little bit, but you didn't need that person.
Yeah. The week that I found out, I broke up with my girlfriend at the time, and I got the letter in the post to say, we've got your results and we found early stages. I was like,
they sent you a letter?
Yeah. It was in the letter. It's very casual. The thing is, over here, I think that everyone knows you have to go for your smear test, and then people talk about like abnormal cells.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not often, like after this happened to me, I would say to my friends, like, oh, you know, you need to go for a regular smear test, because like, you know, number one cause is the HPV virus, and you know, that's what causes the cancer. And they're like, why are you talking about cancer now? I'm like, that's what smear tests are for, to detect cancer.
Well, it's nice to know that like general health knowledge is also lacking in the UK.
I think it's intentionally marketed that way to not scare people.
Yeah, and I get that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. But anyway, oh, it's gone. I've had a total brain fart. This happens to me all the time.
No, it's okay. I mean, you were kind of talking about just like the, when you got the letter in the mail.
Oh yes. Oh yeah. And I broke up with a girlfriend. Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Yeah. So I got the letter.
I'm still taken aback by the fact that they send you a letter in the mail.
I know, it's so casual, isn't it? They were like,
oh my God, that's funny. That makes me laugh.
So on the Wednesday, I was at home. And the thing is, I was at my parent, you know, in my family home. Everyone was away at that point, on holiday or away with school or whatever. No one was there. I was on my own that week. And I opened this letter. I'd forgotten I'd even had the bloody test done. So not only was I shocked to remember that I'd had the test done, I was then shocked to see that I had fucking early cancer. I was like,
oh,
wow, this is really shit. So I was in tears. I called up my girlfriend at the time and I was like, oh, I'm going to, like, this is just what's happened. And she was just like, oh, come over. And, you know, she was very self-centered and quite emotionally abusive and, you know, very star of the show. You know, there wasn't a lot of reciprocity in that relationship. And I got over. And I just sat there, I was like totally stunned. I was like, I forgot I even had the test. Like, this is such a shock. I'm in so much shock. Like, what do I do? What do I do? And I was like freaking out. And she was just sort of sat back from me, didn't even hug me. And she was like, are you finished? I was like, huh? What? And I was like so confused. I like literally couldn't make sense of anything. And she was like, can we talk about our relationship? And I looked at her like stunned. I was like, no, we can't. I've just found out like an hour ago. If you know, another day, but not right now. Like, don't you care about what's happening to me?
Oh my God, I hated it. Hate it.
Yeah.
I just don't, you know, I mean, again, like I can say, I don't understand why people are like this. But again, if the shoe was on the other foot, I don't know. I really don't know. And it's such a strange position to be put in. You know, because no one asked for it. It's not like you're bringing a burden to them that you planned. You know, like, this is just a thing that happened and now we have to deal with it. And people are going to deal with things in different ways.
Yeah.
And it took me years, years, you know, and seeing another friend going through a similar thing with a terminal illness that like really kind of slapped their perspective into space where like not everyone is equipped to stick around and be strong for you.
No.
And, you know, again, it's such a good thing because you don't want those not strong people in your life who are not willing to be able to be there for you.
Yeah, 100%.
So, like, you know, good riddance. Bye.
Oh, definitely. Well, it was funny because I recognized at the time I was only 25. I hadn't started therapy or, you know, really done any proper work on myself yet. So I was like, this woman cannot help me. I think I went home. I was like, I'm going to go home. And 2 days later, she came round to my house and she said, "Do you feel any better today?" I said, "Yeah, I think I do. I was on the phone to my friend and she said some really nice things. And then my partner was like, "Oh, well, that would have been a short list, wouldn't it?" And started then taking the piss and like saying these. And I was like, and I just looked at her and I was like, "I'm not doing this anymore." And she was like, "What?" And our relationship was already on the rocks.
"Get out of my house."
Literally, I was like, "I've got fucking cancer. You obviously can't deal with it. Like, and you know, things are already bad. Like, let's just call it a day."
Yeah. Well, and it impacts after treatment too. Like after you're out of the hospital, like you kind of, like you were saying about the isolation earlier, where like you almost default into being isolated because you don't trust anyone outside of the people who stuck with you, like to be there for you. So like making new friends is super hard in those early stages of being a survivor because you're like, "Nope, these are my people. I remember like being on dating apps like shortly thereafter and you know they'd be like, "Oh, I'd love to take you on a date," and I would just say like, "I don't," or they'd be, or no, sorry, I'm mixing scenarios. The scenario was more like, you know, "Oh, I'm not really that interested, but I'm always happy for friends." And it'd be like, "You know what? I don't need friends. I have plenty of friends. I know who my friends are. It's good." And I remember saying that to people because I was so afraid to like make a new friend that would disappoint me and kind of like leave me in the dust. And like, now I'm over that shit. That's, you know, that was the trauma talking. But, you know, we've moved on from that. But it is super interesting how like, how going through something so like mortality facing changes every component of your life. And one of the points that the point of the book that I try to drive home is that like, you know, being in the position of being a cancer patient, however long you are one, is a job and everything else goes away. You know, my career went away. I had like some up and up opportunities that were happening. I had friendships go away. I had my relationship go away. My hair went away. The body I had worked on for so long had gone away. Like there was a lot of shit that just disappears and you just become this self-identifying full-time professional patient. And like everything else just kind of gets muddied and weird. And it's a very strange perspective because if you're fighting to survive and you're fighting to live, then you're also fighting for those other components. Like I was offered jobs while I was in chemo and I was like, "Can I go do this job?" And my doctor just at one point was just like, "That's behind you now." And that hurt a lot, but it really is just kind of clawing at the person that you used to be as like, it's like being a cat backed in a corner and you're just like, I'm trying to like survive and this is what I want. And that bled over into dating and sex. I went on dates with people while I was in the middle of chemo. And I remember one guy was like, we had like done the date thing. And he at the end was like, "So how long have you been sick?" And I was like, "What?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, like my roommate had whatever this is." And he was like, "I know what this looks like." And I was like, "I don't know what you're talking about. I have to go." Because it just kept popping up in my face. And like, I would hook up with people to try and make myself feel pretty again. And that kind of, this is also covered in the book at nauseam, where like I had a radiation appointment where the radiologist had asked me like, "Oh, you know, what did you do before you were here?" Like very much like, "Hey, you know, you're dead now. What did you used to do?" And I told him like, you know, I was an actor and performer, and he like, you know, we were talking about it. I pulled up my old headshot And I showed it to him and the technician, and they were like, "That's you." And it just was like, ugh, ripped my heart out. And I went home and I like hooked up with a bunch of guys, and it was to try and make myself feel better. And it did the absolute opposite, because once they, because I wasn't using updated photos, like I wasn't using my cancer photos to get people to come over. And like they would just, you know, look away or like bury their face in a pillow or something. And like do everything they possibly could to not look at me. And it made it worse. It didn't help. I thought it would help by making me feel better, but like it sure shit didn't. And you know, I think like one of the big conversations I really want to have over time with like the book and everything that I'm doing around it is just like people just think of a cancer patient as that, as just a cancer patient. And there's so many like human components that are still present that like don't go away, like sex, wanting to be touched, wanting to feel good about yourself. And like, there's so few opportunities in that entire process for that to happen, you know? And like, depending on the severity of the case, it's like, you know, I walked today, I feel good about myself. You know, like when I was in isolation for my stem cell transplant, it was like, I made it a whole lap around the hospital floor. Good for me. But, you know, like, because I, you know, I could barely do it. So, you know, there are those little monument things, but you still want to feel, you still want to like, you still want the human contact, and you still want to feel pretty, you know, because that's gone. It's gone. You don't have it. And it's a reminder every time you look in the mirror that like, whatever you used to look like is just, it's not present, not present at the moment, absent. And that's like kind of a big point I want to drive home, is like the having sex as a cancer patient thing is super weird. And like, you know, the argument as to whether or not you should be doing that in the first place because of health concerns, and like you know, depending on your protocol, you have absolutely no immune system whatsoever. And I certainly had complications surrounding that, but you know, like just I think the image of having sex as a cancer patient is funnier in my head than it actually is in reality. But, you know, it's like, I want to have like with someone who is like a professional, either psychologist or medical professional, about the constructs around that. Like, who put such a high price on having sex? Well, I mean, society, but also if it makes you feel better about yourself, then why wouldn't you do it? But then you're in a scenario where doing it doesn't make you feel better about yourself. So then why are you doing it? And it's just like this triangle of like, what are you doing? This is PTSD and trauma.
I think as well, if you're facing death, I think there's an element, or you feel like you might be, there's an element of like, well, if I've not got much longer left, then...
Right, then stick it in.
I want to smash.
Smash your past.
Yeah.
It's never past. Yeah, I mean, and that's true. And I think I'm doing my audiobook now. So I'm rereading this for the first time in a while. And after it's been edited and everything. And there definitely is a part where I say, like, there was a lot of, you know, fuck it, let's do it kind of thing. Because we didn't know how the outcome was going to be. Mm-hmm. So it was like, do I want to... you know, go out and drink myself stupid until 3 a.m? No. Was I going to do it because like it was good for me? No. But did I do it because it like was party time normalcy? Absolutely. Like mm-hmm. I drank through chemo, which is definitely not something you should do. Like your liver already is like, what is happening? What is this like nuclear situation happening? And then like dumping booze all over it. Like what in the fuck, you know? But that's, I did that. I fucked and drank my way through through cancer.
And you're the first person to have, like you were saying, to have survived. So maybe. Well,
that particular type, yes.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not it was a good idea, I guess it worked.
Maybe
it was the dick that saved me.
We're prescribing chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and penis.
And penis. Have at it. Maximum dose.
It's interesting, though. I do wonder if, like, I don't know if you're into energy and blah, 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 but there's part of me that wonders about maybe what you were doing was like really activating your kind of life force, your energy, your fire. So maybe from a health perspective, it wasn't a good idea, but maybe on some other level, like, it was good.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and I think that's like a really, that's a much longer conversation, I think, because like there is that duality of like physically, health-wise, probably shouldn't have been doing it. There is an astronomical amount of risk associated with having sex with strangers or even people you know, when you have zero immune system and your body's destroyed from chemo. But on the energetic side of it, like, do you watch What We Do in the Shadows?
No.
Hulu? Okay. Oh, right. You guys
we don't
have
Hulu
over there. Right. Never mind. Something I just learned recently. but it's the show about, like, it's a quote unquote reality TV show, like mockumentary kind of thing about these vampires that are alive in modern times. And one of them is an energy vampire. He doesn't look like a regular vampire. He's like this old man with glasses, and he just comes around people and he's like, "My cat died yesterday." And then people are like, "Oh," and he like sucks the energy out of them. So that is now what I'm envisioning in my head about what I was doing. I'm like, my body's depleted and I feel gross, but you're hot.
Got it.
Literally. So yeah, I mean, like, maybe there's something to explore there, where maybe that was like a transference of energy or something, you know, like some kind of like other level healthcare thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I think for me, what it conjures with the sort of the partying and the drinking, it's very much like, I'm here. You know, it's this real sort of claiming of presence. And, you know, with the sex thing, regardless of what it did psychologically, I think there's, you know, with sex, there's this experience, if you, you know, are kind of mentally present enough to be there in the moment and you're not dissociating or something. But I think, you know, there's this thing of like, we're touching each other, like I'm physically here, you know, that like.
Actually, like, relevant to the mortality thing that we were talking about earlier, maybe that has something to do with it, where, you know, like, and there's the other component of this is that I didn't tell anyone that I had cancer. My family knew and my closest friends knew and everyone else, I disappeared. So like, it was isolating in that sense that like no one knew. It was just the people closest to me. And so maybe like having people that were not in that circle pay attention to me and be physical and like have that like person to person touch component that wasn't familial or friendly was another, like, again, another level of like some kind of healing. It was like, I'm here, I'm alive, you know, like feeling my body, I'm alive, I'm mortal.
Yeah.
And still here. So yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point. I don't know. But that would be something I will probably explore later in my brain.
I know that for me, there was somebody that I slept with before I had my sort of little surgery to remove the bad bits. And I'm actually trying to recall who it was, because around that age I made a few bad choices.
I mean, at 25, you're supposed to make bad
choices. Yeah, it's fine.
Whatever, it's fine. You're still alive. It's all that matters.
Yeah, exactly. But I just remember thinking in my head, like, this is the last time I'm going to have sex as I am, like, with all of me intact, even if it's a bit moldy. And I was like, you know,
not moldy.
I was like, by the time I do this again, I will be forever changed. You know, it's going to take me a while to heal. I don't know if psychologically I'm going to be up for that yet, like for ages. And I don't know if I'm going to be traumatized by this. So there was this real sense for me before I had my surgery of being like, well, I'm going to do this now, not knowing when the time will come again. And yeah.
I think that's a commonality between all people who go through something like that. There are two photos that I have that are the day of me being checked in for long term, because all my chemo was inpatient, because it was like 8 and 9 hour chemo drips. So like I had to live at the hospital for like a week or two at a time, depending. And so there's a picture of me going to the hospital, and there's a picture of me sitting in the hospital before chemo started. And I kind of look at those as like the last photo of me before all this shit happened, you know, and like the last photo of me, period. Obviously, that's not true, but the last photo of him.
Yeah.
And in the foreword of my book, the preface, excuse me, I compare it to Six, the musical, where it's like, you know, the divorced, beheaded, survived. And the beheaded part is really kind of divorcing yourself from, you know, I mean, literally divorcing yourself first and then killing that person off and realizing that they're not, that's not you anymore. Mm. And you're a new person. And the person in that photo of me sitting in a hospital bed, he doesn't exist, and he hasn't existed for 10 years. Mm. And as much as I tried to go backwards in time to kind of like figure out how to be that person again, it's not possible. You can't. It's like, stop trying. It's a waste of energy. Move forward. Figure out who you are now. Cause like trying to create a person in the present from the past, like, kind of a waste of energy. I had someone say this to me, and it was about a breakup. Trying to get back together with an ex, but I think it applies here as well. And they said, getting back together with an ex and or this scenario of trying to be the person you were before is like trying to shove a piece of shit back into your asshole. And I was like, yeah, what a great scenario. Because like you immediately picture it and you're like, yep, it's messy. It's not going to work. It might stick for a minute, but it's not good. Don't do that.
I'm going to remember that until the day I die.
I hope so. Get a t-shirt that says it or something. Or like a little needle point that you can hang on the wall.
Oh, I love that. That's incredible.
But that's, you know, that's kind of the scenario that I think about, like trying to pretend that you're the same person you were before.
Yeah, I mean, you for can. Me, my life is absolutely, it's weird because logically, and even from a trauma perspective, I don't, like, whilst yes, I went through the cancer thing, it's not the worst thing that I've ever been through. So I think for me, it's interesting that I don't feel like, by the time this happened, I was like, I've been through worse. Like, this is terrible, but I've been through worse. And so I sort of didn't feel as traumatized, I think, because I felt more confident in my ability to handle whatever it was going to be. And yet my life is absolutely in two parts. It's the before and the after cancer.
Yeah.
Like 100%. And I think the way that I made sense out of it and the way that I kind of, it didn't stop me, was that it gave me, I think, because I spent the whole year, I got tested, I think, at the beginning of February, and I only got the all clear in the December. So I literally spent that entire year, pretty much, or 11 months, thinking and talking about cancer. And then there's like and after that, I was like, well, I could have died and I didn't. So now that I know that and I faced it, I need to live my life differently, and something changed. I started taking myself more seriously, because before that I was a doormat, like a professional, like 5-star doormat. So I feel personally like life was much worse before cancer.
I think that also is chalked up to youth as well. Like, you're 25 and stupid, you know, like, like I talk about this a lot too, where like the person that I was before cancer, like, I don't want to hang out with him. He's a fucking cunt. I don't want to see him. Like, what a dick. You know, cause like I was a know-it-all, and I was like this young, pretty, like working all the time actor, which was a privilege. And I was lucky to, but I just thought I knew everything. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm 25. I have it all figured out. And like, I look back and some of the shit that came out of my mouth back then, it was just like, oh my God, heaven help the people that knew me back then. I hope they don't hate me now and realize that I'm not that person anymore.
What is it, do you think, that you miss the most about that version of him?
I was not afraid of anything.
Mm.
I had no, and I don't know if this is something to chalk up to youth and stupidity, but like, I had no stresses really about money. Like, I didn't really have any, but it was kind of like, it doesn't matter, it's fine. And, you know, life was, it was work, but it was a party. And it was exciting in a sense that like, I was still figuring stuff out. And I was fortunate enough to do all the things that I wanted to do. Sorry, I'm choking over here. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, I think I miss the reckless abandon of that guy.
Mm.
And my mom, I remember her telling me, excuse me, what is going on? I remember her telling me at that point that I had lived, excuse me, it sounds like I'm crying, I'm not. I'm literally just choking. It's fine, everything's fine. Edit that attack out. No, you don't have to. My mom at one point before then told me that I had lived enough life for 5 people up to that point.
Wow.
And I think that's still true. Even after that, but up to that point, I was not afraid of anything. I would do anything. I would go anywhere. And now I'm like, leave me alone. I'm comfortable in my house. Like, you know, I still want to travel and do things. And my trip to Paris and London was very much like, fuck it, I'm going to do whatever I want. And it was very back to that kind of headspace of being like 24 and being like, I'm going to go do whatever I want. No consequences. And rah, 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 rah. So I missed that. But he had an attitude problem. and I've actually started to practice talking about myself pre-cancer in the third person, where it's like, he was not, you know, that's not part of me. He is not part of me.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's been helpful, I think.
there's a new Netflix, it's kind of a documentary film with Jonah Hill, mm-hmm, interviewing his psychotherapist.
Oh, I've heard about this. I haven't watched it, but
I've started watching it this week, and it's really pertinent to what you were just saying about how you view that previous self, and it's just really interesting.
I think it's necessary, and maybe this is, you know, I haven't watched it. I'm not big into like trauma research, obviously. I'm not a doctor, but like, I wonder if there's something having to do with trauma healing, in a sense where like that person just isn't you, and like you view that person as a separate person that you can learn from and like model. Like, there are people in my life that I wouldn't necessarily say they're friends, I wouldn't say they're not friends, but they're definitely people that I view as like future self cautionary tales, like, don't become like this person, watch what they're doing and don't do that. And so in the reciprocity of that, like looking back at my former self and looking at that and being like, don't be like that person anymore. Don't do that.
Mm.
And just kind of like looking at those two vantage points and being like, okay, I fall in the middle here. I'm okay. It's fine. Everything's fine. And just try and kind of be the best human you can.
Yeah, 100%. I think the extra piece that I needed in that healing was learning to have genuine compassion for that version. Like, whatever it was, when I used to pick like terrible partners who treated me really badly, I used to think, God, you were such an idiot. And now I'm like, you were trying to be loved when you didn't know what that looked like.
Yeah. I mean, you don't know what you don't know, and you can't be blamed for that.
Yeah.
You know, and again, when you're 25, you're fucking stupid. So how could you know?
It's true. true. Edward, I can't believe that the time has flown so quickly.
I know, and I'm so sorry that I have to go. This has been
No,
fun.
it's been lovely, and I will invite you back another time. Edward, tell everyone what your book is called or where they can get it.
Sure. The book is called I will hold it up for you so we can get a visual off not off my ring light. It's called Cancer, Musical Theater, and Other Chronic Illnesses. And it is available on Barnes and Noble. It is on Indigo if you're in Canada. It's on Booktopia if you're in Australia. And it is on Amazon if you are everywhere else.
Amazing. Thank you so much. If people want to find you on social media, what are your handles and all that sort of thing?
All of them are Edward Miski, at Edward Miski, EDWARDIMISKIE. I must spell my name wrong there.
I'll put it in the show notes. It's all good.
Perfect. Yeah. Also, I'll send you all the things. But yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your story today. It's been amazing.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed it or found it insightful, please leave me a review and share it with others. You can find the Transsection podcast on social media or go to mooksharrishill.com/transsection to sign up to our mailing list. See you next time.